My name is Kim. My second name is Friele. I was born in Bergen in 1935, which means that I'm nearly 75. When I was 26, I've been married for 1 year. I broke after marriage. I worked in insurance business as a PR consultant. You know what I mean by that. In 63, I joined the gay and lesbian movement. And to me, that was a shock because nobody was open. Everybody was suppressed. I have been open all my life. When my marriage broke up, I was married for 1 year. From 59 till 60. When the marriage broke up, I didn't want to lie. I didn't want to not to be open about everything. So I said to myself, okay, if you start to lie now, you will lie for several years. I was open in my family. Of course, it was a shock for a couple of months, then it was okay. I was open at work from day one. And it would be blasphemy if I say that I have had any problems ever. I never have had. When I joined the movement, it took me 2 years to find them because they were underground. But when I found them and joined, I was shocked about how gay and lesbian life was. I was born in Bergen. We had no organized groups for gays and lesbians there. I hardly knew what it was. Then I said to myself, this is not life.
What was the state of this movement when you found it?
They were anonymous, everyone. We were about 130 members. At the time I joined, there were only four women or five women or six women, I don't remember. It was a good social climate. We met once a month, but it was all undercover. Nobody had any name. The clubhouse we went to was anonymous. Everything was anonymous. But let me say, it was like coming home when I finally, coming from outside Oslo, finally met somebody who could bring me into the movement.
Was there a name to this movement?
It was, as you probably have heard already, the name was DNF48. But the name they, to get people to join them, all advertisements was city and country join hands. So, you see, it was like somebody from outside some farmer place somewhere came in and city people joined them and we all loved each other. Of course, it had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. But that's how it was. At the time, we had the penal law. You could go to jail. The psychiatric diagnose, the church, the law. And to me, who had grown up in a very liberal home, and I was me, I met another world, and I thought, why do these people cry? Why don't they feel proud of who they are? They're not criminals. I'm not sick. They're not sick. What is wrong? I was very naive. I was brought up in a very conservative home, but I was brought up in a home with a large amount of tolerance. People were not alike. They were, of course, we were different, but we all had our own worth.
What was the purpose of this organization in 1962? Was it a community building thing, or was it already a political group?
Maybe somebody would, you know, I won't say that the Norwegian movement at that time was political. It was a social, it was a try to make warm and social meeting place for gay and people from all over the country. That was the main thing, to let people breathe once a month, to comfort them. There were debates, there were discussions, but most of all, we met, said goodbye, and met again a month after. But what the board, the people on the board that time, tried very hard was to do something about the law, who could put men into jail for 1 year.
And how did this early movement politicize itself, and what is your role in this process?
Yeah, okay. I started out in 65. I was asked, would I agree to be open out in society? Would I be willing to write articles in the newspapers under my full name? Was it okay for me to lobby in Parliament? Was it okay for me to knock on the door to any psychiatrist?
You were asked by who?
I was asked by the people in the movement.
As a kind of consensual...
Yeah, yeah. So they made me head of information. I had my job in insurance. Like all other gay and lesbian at that time, we worked on our spare time. We were not paid. And I felt it an honor. And I knew that some breaks would make more people come out. Now, that didn't happen until 1973. In the meantime, I wrote articles. I invited myself to student groups to talk to them. I invited myself to Parliament to talk to politicians, regardless what party. I invited myself to the church to talk to theological students. And at the beginning, silence was the big thing. Nothing in the press except my small articles.
What was your political discourse at the time? What is the agenda that you were trying to push?
The agenda was, it's wrong to criminalize gay men.
So it was specifically focused on the issue of criminalization.
That was from 1966 until the law was abolished in 1972. And I had a wonderful, wonderful, my colleagues, my chef in insurance business, I could leave my work, I could travel. They didn't take 1 cent of my wage. I just worked overtime when I came back. So I went to Trondheim, I went to Bergen, I went to the student unions in these cities, I contacted the press. I tried as hard as I could to push this paragraph, this horrible thing, on the agenda. And my message was, okay, maybe I'm a sinner, maybe we are sinners, maybe we'll go to hell, but don't put us into jail, don't put our boys into jail. Okay, maybe we're sick. Do you punish sick people? And my tactic was, okay, that's okay, let's take it. But I want them to participate in writing a book that whatever they mean, don't criminalize. And that was a success. I got people from Norway, lawyers, writers, psychiatrists, priests, and I got people from Holland, from England, from the Albany Trust in England, who fought for getting away with the English law, and put together a book. I was editor. I wrote the first two pages, and this book made a sensation. We were able to collect money, so we printed it in about 2,000-3,000 copies. That was very good at that time. And distributed it to all members of parliament, to lawyers, to psychiatrists, to priests, and a man from the Norwegian Social Democratic Party at that time. Unfortunately, he doesn't live anymore. He raised the question in Parliament immediately before Christmas, just a fortnight after the book came out. And that started it all. And then I was invited to the Committee of Justice in Parliament and to the different groups, regardless of parties, who had their seat in the Justice Committee. From Holland, we got the so-called Speyer Report. That was an official report who said that you could not seduce anyone to become a homosexual. That is stupid. I broke my arm, and I used my sick period to translate this report from English into Norwegian, raise the money, and in record time got it printed and sent it to the government and to the parliament just a couple of days before the government should decide whether to at all raise this question.
Was this an active law? In other words, were people truly being penalized?
No.
Or? No. It was a dormant law.
It was, a sleeping law. But nevertheless, if you have a law that doesn't work and you don't dare to abolish it, that's a bad law.
Of course.
That's a very bad law.
Is this the beginning of the movement as a movement?
Yeah, I think it is.
A political organization?
Yeah, I think so. But the real start of the political movement started in 69 with a student uproar in Paris, when the women started to uprise in United States, when we got the new young generation in Norway of very political students, left, communists, if you would like, the most bright student, and then they began in 73 to join the organization. And a person like me, who was stupid politically, had my best years. Because then I understood that it isn't enough just to abolish the law and then, well, we don't go to jail, but at least we're sick, we are sinners, and so on. So, You could say that the students in Paris, the students in Norway, the women uprising in the United States, the uprising of the colored people in the United States, we saw the likeness between...
And Stonewall.
Yeah, and Stonewall, of course Stonewall. But the story of Stonewall did not reach us here until 71. Until 71. It reached some of us who got magazines from USA, who read about it. Remember, at that time, we didn't have internet. We didn't have more than one television station. That was the Norwegian one. We didn't know what was going on. So either we had to have friends who told us, write to us, or, as I did, got the Advocate, the Mattachin, and American magazines, gay and lesbian magazines. That's how I knew. That was my awakening. Mm-hmm. And you could say that from 72, from April 72, when we woke up and the Parliament had abolished the law, then we could start a much broader political work for human rights.
What was the repercussion of the law in society? I mean, I understand the repercussion of the law for the formation of the movement, but did it have ripples in terms of how it reached people outside?
Oh yes. And when it came to it, we had an investigation, and most of the Norwegian people didn't know about the law. Even the politicians didn't know the law. They were astonished when they first were confronted with the law. And that has something to do with what you mentioned. It wasn't in use. They didn't dare to use it. Mm. They used the ordinary law, that you were punished if you had sex with a young person under 16 years of age.
And it's a law that was in place since when?
The law was in place at 1902. Mm. 1902. And you had some cases during the 50s. Later, I think that today you would say that most of those cases had to do about pedophiles. Mm. I had a lot of gay friends in the 60s who were hooked, as we say, but they never raised any case against them under these 213 paragraph. Mm-hmm. They used the ordinary paragraph. That also showed how stupid it was to upheld it in the Norwegian law. And I said at one time that if you should use that law, 213, then you would have to arrest a lot of famous Norwegians. Mm. You do that. Mm-hmm. And they were shocked. And this kind of arguments and the showing of the stupidity. And of course, I think we choose the right tactic. Mm. Well, at least the law disappeared. Then we started the work in schools. We started to demand that no teacher be sacked if he chooses to be open. No teacher be hindered in getting higher, because of his sexual orientation. And we succeeded. Then we started on the military. At this time, after 73, it was not only me, thanks God, officially anymore. Of course, a bunch of people have been working and making the tactic and joining with the knowledge of law, with the knowledge of medicine, with the knowledge of everything. But I was the one who took their things and went out.
Public face.
Yeah, was the public. After 73, 1,000 people came. We were at a time in 74, I think, about 2,000 members. That is nearly as many as today.
What is the image of the homosexual, the gay and the lesbian that you are presenting to the heterosexual community at the time? What is the kind of identity that is being formed and quote-unquote sold to advance this law?
Well, even if I'm as old as 75, I've always enjoyed what you call diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did not, and I have never, never presented us in a way saying, we are as good as you, we are just like you,
mm-hmm.
because we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how heterosexuals are. I only know how we are. And I think it's stupid, because the point of this all is to accept that we are different, that we are unique, that we represent a color, that it's wrong ideology, and in any way to say that the main purpose in society is that everyone dress alike, everyone has the same kind of hair, everyone loves the same music.
Mm-hmm.
We are different. And of course, some women are masculine, so what?
Mm-hmm.
Some life is, so what? We shouldn't be like formed out of, you know, not to be criminal. It's wrong to criminalize love, and wrong to criminalize people because they're not like you, because they choose another lover, because they don't fight over you, your woman. Their fight for their own man.
When does the concept of equality start to play a role within the gay and lesbian movement? I know the concept of equality has been fundamental to the building of the welfare state in Norway.
Mm.
Not necessarily along the lines of sexual orientation or gender identity, but ingrained in the building of this society.
I would say in the midst of the 70s.
And what did that mean for the gay and lesbian movement, this question of equality?
At the beginning, I think we were all astonished about this, because in the deep inside of us, particularly my generation, it was nearly too good to be true. Were we really, when it comes to it, really equal? So it took some time to understand that whether you have another color, whether you have another sexual orientation, whether you have Down syndrome, whether you have something that does not function, you know, you limp or you what, we're all worthy people. And we began to see the likeness, the red threads, and suddenly we had a much wider perspective of what we were working at, and we didn't forget that some people had another color. We took it into the, we saw the likeness, we saw that the fight we fought was much alike the fight the women fought, the color people fought, the people, other people, suppressed people.
Is that along the lines of the ideological foundation of the gay and lesbian movement under your direction? Or what is it?
Well, I think that, as naive as I was taught by the young people in the student unions. I was taught by the new feminists. And when, as we say, the light, I saw the light, that was a revolution in my head. And I used my long experience and my authority, together with other lesbians and gay, with the same political attitude and the same goal for what we were striving at, to sort of say, it's going to be like this, you know, or nothing. We don't go for the second best. We have to be patient, but no, we go for the very best.
And now we are in what year?
Now we are at the end of the 70s. The 70s was the most active years. When we took to the streets, when we really, in writing and so on, formulated us, you know, politically, no doubt. We succeeded that the Norwegian Psychiatric Union demolished that and declared it's not a sickness. We succeeded that those boys who wanted to join the army, whether to stay there or just for those months they had to go there, should have the right to be open and have their full rights, because in 76 they didn't. They could not have any education within the military. They could not be a flyer, an air, they had nothing. They were bee people. We didn't bother that they joined the military. We didn't say out of NATO and that sort of thing. The only thing we said is our boys or girls should have equal rights, equal responsibility, and should not be, pissed on, as we said.
But by this time, are you already an official movement, and how is it funded?
We are an official movement, but we funded ourselves.
By we did donation?
We do not have any support from the state at all. It had to go 10 more years before we got that. We had a restaurant here in Oslo. We managed to get hold of it, and it was the only one in Oslo in the 70s. We made a lot of money, and all the members and we all of them agreed, let's pay our bills, and when the bills are paid, all the rest of the money goes to the political work. That's why they could afford I quit the insurance business. I was offered a position as general secretary in 1972, and I was there until 1989. So it was continuity. They always had a person who could front when you studied and the other one went to work. That was very good, because the press knew how they could phone in the midst of the day, not disturbing him as a teacher or whatever. It was a good thing. And then we could afford to have one person in Trondheim and one person in Bergen who worked as I did. So we had we worked together, and the young man in Trondheim took the midst of Norway, and the person in Bergen took that part of the country, and I administered those open we'd had in the Oslo area and outside, and sent them out, those who could.
What is your relationship during the 70s and towards the late of the 70s with the other social movements, namely the feminist movement and the political movements such as the Marxist-Leninist, the Maoist-Leninist, and so on and so forth? Are you going together, or have you already marked some differences?
Some differences have been marked. The New Feminist, I joined them. I worked in the gay lesbian movement. I didn't want to leave them. I didn't want to leave the boys. But I joined the lesbian movement and joined them to get equality for the lesbian inside the Norwegian gay and lesbian movement. Because there were men not to say anything bad about men, but gay men are men. So we claim to get our own evenings where no man was in sight. So we did the same as the women, other women did, to try to raise our men, make them see that we were invisible. We have never been under the law 213, only men. So we didn't, we were nobody. We made the coffee, we made, and we listened. We listened to these poor gay guys. So that was a struggle. It didn't last too long. When it comes to the Marxist-Leninists or Maoist, there was a break. There was finally a break. The movement was full of rage. They were a little group. They were so clever. I've never worked together with people whom I admire so much for their hard working, for their intelligence, those students. But when it came down to it, I couldn't join them because they said homosexuality will disappear after the revolution. Because this has nothing to do with being born or having chosen. This is the result of capitalism.
The bourgeoisie.
Sorry. So it came to a break. It had to come to a break. But it was a very sore time because friendships were broken up. We lost very many hard-working, good people.
And the break meant that you took the stance to separate because of this ideological conviction of the Maoists, and some of them stayed on.
Yes? They were not thrown out because they were Marxist-Leninists.
Okay.
But 32 of them, regardless whether they were Marxist-Leninist or not, were thrown out when they officially brought out a message that it was very, very important to find the causes of homosexuality, that it could be cured, or maybe should be cured. That was so in opposition to be proud, come out of the closet, enjoy your life, be proud of yourself, that it had to come to that.
That is what you are talking about at this point? Come out of the closet.
Be proud, come out of the closet. You're unique. You have the right to choose your own life, to choose who you want to love, and so on.
Are these tactics already in conversation with the tactics used in other countries in the movement? Or is it something that you are building?
I think it is the same. I think it is the same. But if you go to Sweden or Denmark or even United States or even England, you didn't have a kind of Maoist, Leninist or whatever movement like we had in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't. So they didn't fully understand what we talked about. So they were sorry that we were divided. They were sorry that we couldn't work together. It took some time before they realized that this had to do with our future. What kind of society did we want?
Mm-hmm.
Did we all want to go in gray uniforms? Did we all want to say hello to Mao or to China? And what will this do to our identity? So the break had to come, and it was a very it was not a good thing. Those were not good years, But of course we had many things we could work in common for. The psychiatrist to get away that we were sick. But the Maoist Leninists said that maybe it could be cured. Now what do they say that? That it is something that isn't really well. You don't cure what is well, what is healthy, what is good for you. Mm-hmm. So, but we work together. We work together for the anti-racism law. We had good work together. We work together when it comes to getting equal rights for boys in the military or girls. We worked good together for other things as well, but we couldn't be in the same organization for the other reasons I've mentioned.
What is the next development, if you will? You're coming into the 80s. I understand there is an anti-discrimination law that takes place early 80s.
In 81. Uh-huh. In 81. And we demanded this because we were discriminated in restaurants. We were hanged out in the press with the most horrible things they accused us for. And finally, having started that work at 75, then 6 years later, we got this anti-racist law supplied with sexual orientation. It was more symbolic, but it meant a lot. It meant it was a message out to the public and to the press and to that there is a limit. You may say a lot, but there is a limit. And we thought that was a success, even if we knew that we wouldn't go to court every other day, but we could use it. Now, if you don't let me come into your restaurant to have a beer, I am going to the police. So we got in and got our beer. So it was a paragraph who raised the Norwegian people, made them a little bit brighter, made them a little more tolerant, made them to understand a little more. Now the next thing was that we had the HIV. My partner and I went to United States both at 82 and 83. At 82, we spoke at the International Gay and Lesbian International Day, you know, in June, in San Francisco. And we were invited to the mayor, and we met a lot of people. And that was the first time we met people with AIDS. When we came back, two famous Norwegian gay people, one called Georg Pettersen, who was a doctor, and the other one called Kalle Almedal, they had already picked up that something horrible was about to happen, which was not a gay virus. So when my partner and I come home, I contacted them. Naturally enough, I was still general secretary of the organization of which they were members. And they put this thing on the agenda, the HIV and AIDS. And of course that was a very hard time, because not only should you give information to your own people, you should stand up against all the horrible things in press, in TV, in radio, that this was a gay virus and you had yourself to thank for it. If you had behaved otherwise, so this meant that homosexuality was a sickness. It was amoralish and so on. So a lot of work was put into that. And of course, some of the information work producing information material and so on had to be put aside for a couple of years, both to get this health group on their feet and to use some of our money to make them start. But after a while, they got their first money from the state. And then the organization got their first money, because they saw the link between information in general and working against HIV. They saw how important it was to have information about homosexuality and gay and lesbian life in schools to prevent that the debut ended in crisis. I think that this committee, as I called it, which is a big thing today, did a marvelous job. Did a marvelous job. And of course, the money from the state, because of this, which later led to money to the information as well, because the government and everybody realized the good work both groups were doing, made, excuse my words, a hell of a lot of change. And so we started with the partnership law.
At this time, internationally, there is already the beginning of what's understood as queer studies.
Yeah.
And it seems from that there was some kind of division, if you will, between the interest of the of your organization and these theories that are coming about.
Yeah.
The kind of renouncing to categorizations.
Yeah.
What it's called a kind of homonormativization,
yeah,
of homosexuality and so on. Could you speak to that? To that criticism of perhaps the organization taking on these categories and not necessarily listening to these issues raised in queer studies?
I'll be very honest with you. I'm an old woman of 75. I started out naive, and to me, and now I'm very honest with you, to me this was uninteresting. That has nothing to do with my intellectual. It has nothing to do with saying that other people are stupid, because...
Right.
But the person I am, I thought it was very much more important to take care of those who wanted to take their own lives, who didn't dare to come out of the closet, who were thrown out of their homes. Instead, so I call it intellectual masturbation.
Mm.
Sorry, my words.
Yeah.
I didn't join. Now, one thing that at that time was also that my old brain, I didn't really understood. Maybe my brain was too little to understand it. And I thought it was so... and I was also very, very afraid that we should lose the most valuable thing on earth, The right to be different. The right to be different. Why? Why do we have to abolish gay, homosexual, bisexual, and so on? Why? Why? Is it because then we should all be alike?
Did you find that it could hinder the political achievement
yes.
of your organization? In that way, that rejection was also strategic, if you will?
Look, at that time, when this started, I was no longer general secretary in the organization. Mm-hmm. I was working in the Department for Culture as a... I was appointed to take care of special things. I don't know what Staatsstipendiat is in English. Mm-hmm. It's you are appointed by the king in the when the ministers are. It's not an ordinary scholarship. It's a special one. So I was appointed not in spite of being lesbian, but because I have been working for such a long time that they asked me, would I please go on lecturing, concentrate on that. And so what I did was doing that. And those intellectuals, the used hours in it was not just my table. Mm. Something had to do, I guess, with my stupidity. But honest to my heart, it had to do with my work was the more happy lesbians and gay people I saw, the more I think life has been worth it. Right. This had to do something about generation. I am born in 35. I was about 50, 60 at this time. I was about 65 when this queer debate began. I have lived my life when nobody was open except myself for 10 years. I've lived my life with violence. Mm. I have lived my life struggling to be heard, together with, after 73, other people. We are all today between 60 and 84. Mm. I always say, never punish a person for being born too late. Mm. Never punish a person for being born too late. But those persons have the, what do you say, maybe they haven't struggled as much. They have been sitting in their study rooms and I was a woman, and those coming up were gay men, bright gay men. But when you are a gay man of 25, having to struggle with an old witch lesbian of 52, who knows where to put the cobber, as we say, there's a time for everything. A new generation came with new ideas, with a lot of money, which we haven't had, with internet, with international cooperation and so on.
Looking back at all of these achievements in terms of legislation, what do you think what was the platform that allowed for this to happen so rapidly in Norway in comparison to other countries?
Yeah, I think because we were so backwards. We started on scratch.
Okay.
And I think that having a law who punished gay men, regardless of age, even if you were 90 and went to bed with a man of 85, and somebody didn't like it, you had the fright of being put into jail. Mm. I think that we were, in a way, outside. We were we were not in Europe like the other countries. So we were starting on scratch. And I think that that was the most wonderful thing that could happen, because gays and lesbians took the lead. We took the lead in sexual revolution. We took the lead in speaking loudly about sex. And I think instead of being Sweden and Denmark, in Denmark they have been, sort of liberal after 1955. In Sweden too, they had no law, except they had one discriminating law. If you were under 18, you could be punished. Mm-hmm. We were backwards, and we set out in our boat with all to achieve and nothing to lose. Nobody could tell us about the law we didn't have. Nobody could tell us about So we took the grip.
I would be interested in knowing your thoughts about the relationship between the legislation that was achieved, the political work, in relationship to the cultural reception and self-perception of homosexuality. Do you think they have been going hand in hand? In other words, has the law helped for less discrimination, a different kind of perception, or not? Mm. Are those things parallel and synchronic, or they aren't?
They are in the same family. When young people are asked, whether in television or whatever, what is the greatest achievement in the Norwegian gay and lesbian movement? Oh, it's the new marriage law. Oh, it's the partnership law. Mm-hmm. I don't agree. Those are great big successes and achievements. But you can't build a house without starting at the bottom.
Starting at the bottom is what?
Getting away with a law which put gay men, or could put gay men, into prison. You would not come into schools if the Norwegian society said you are a potential criminal. You couldn't come into parliament and they would listen to you. If the person you were talking to think he is a potential criminal, we have to be, you know. Everything starts at the right order at the right time.
And do you see with this great experience of yours of so many years that Norway is a more quote-unquote tolerant country in regards to these issues? Is it a place where homosexuals live open lives?
No doubt.
In accord to the law?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No doubt. And this is an example of that law. You cannot do away with its discrimination only by law. You cannot do away with bad, with intolerance only by laws. But they are there and signalize that this country do not accept it, whether you like it or not. So all of these laws together has made the Norwegian church as well, very many priests and bishops, change. They also, they read the Bible in another way today than 40 years ago or 45 years ago. And of course, we are not an island out somewhere alone. We are a rich country. We are a member today of the world. We are not a funny icy thing up there on the North Pole. And we have been taught by other movements, other countries, the struggling in South Africa, the Martin Luther King. There are so many to say thank you to. And we have gained from that.
What now? I mean, it seems like Norway is perhaps the most advanced country in terms of legislation. Everything is, there is 100% equal citizenship in terms of sexual orientation. What is the current struggle? I mean,
well,
what is the urgency for young people?
Yeah, the sad thing is I'm traveling a lot, visiting schools and so on. And when I travel to the outskirts of Norway, I find young people with this, the same problem as 40 years ago.
What is that?
It's, do I dare to tell my parents? Do I dare to tell my my football, you know, friends? Do I dare to tell where I live? So I used to say that we who had it fairly good in the 70s have got it better and better and better. But a new generation, and remember that is my grandchildren generation, they start out the way we all did. Who am I? How I'm going to find out? How I'm going to accept it?
So what does that mean? What is the work that needs to be done in that regard?
We have to put our sources into schools, into football teams, into youth clubs. We have to stand up for gay and lesbians all over the countries, not only in the big cities. And of course we have to rely on that one person in the dark west comes out. If that happens, maybe next year 10 will be out. But we mustn't only concentrate on international meetings, big offices, going to parliament and having all these laws. Nobody's soul can survive by telling a 17-year-old boy, oh, when you're 18, you can get married if you want to. What does that mean to a boy who's sitting alone crying, whose only connection with the gay community is his chatting? Does that give him any warmth? Does that make him dare to go into the sitting room and tell his mother and father? And that is the sad thing, that we have to do it over and over and over again. But the lucky thing is that today we are accepted as an organization with money, they listen to it, and it's easier for us to give hope to the young gay and lesbians struggling. Even in the church, it's more hope today than ever before.